It's kind of a big deal to get an interview with the high-ranking leader of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, for whatever reason. I mean, we've tried over the years, like a lot of journalists, but it just doesn't happen very often. In some cases, it doesn't happen at all with presidents of the church. Now, it could be a decision made by the president himself, but I think it's usually the people managing the image of the faith who see to it that these interviews are rare. Again, for whatever reason. It took The Atlantic magazine something like a year to arrange an interview with the current LDS president, Russell M. Nelson. Lots of negotiations, I imagine. They had to fly in and meet Nelson first, months before it actually happened. And it may have helped that the Atlantic journalist who wanted to do the interview, McKay Coppins, is a practicing Latter-day Saint. Coppins wanted to write about Mormonism as it celebrates its 200th year and explore what a third century of the faith will look like. So that may have helped that he was Mormon. I don't know. But whatever, he got the interview last April, just as the COVID pandemic was shutting everything down.
I remember walking from my hotel in downtown Salt Lake City to Temple Square, and everything was deserted. Everything on Temple Square was shut down. And in fact, to get into the church administration building, I had to meet somebody who escorted me through this maze of checkpoints, through an underground garage and up a restricted elevator and through a security desk where my temperature was taken. And then finally, I got into this big mahogany-walled conference room. And I kind of just waited there for a few minutes. And finally, this door opened to the side and in walked President Russell M. Nelson, president of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
Were you nervous?
I guess in two senses. You know, one is just the journalistic nervousness I always have before a big interview.
Yeah.
And then there was this kind of other sort of weird nervousness that I guess was more personal. I mean, this is the president of a church that I belong to, the leader of a faith that I belong to. And from the very beginning of this project, I knew there would be this kind of awkward tension between my own personal feelings and my journalistic objective. And there were a bunch of different anxieties and nervousness and feelings that I was kind of dealing with as I was beginning that interview.
And he wants to begin the conversation, the interview, with a prayer. What did you make of that? And because I was wondering, did he know that you were a member of his faith? Or do you think he would do this with, you know, with all correspondents of national magazines who came to see him?
It's a good question. I can't speak for any other correspondents or what he would do with other journalists. He did know I was a member of the faith. I don't know how much he knew about my experience with the church or how active I was or anything else, but he certainly felt comfortable beginning with a prayer. It was kind of an interesting experience. I do think that it's not that uncommon, though, for faith leaders of his stature to, you know, pray with or suggest praying with journalists. I know that that's happened in other churches or religious traditions as well.
You say in the piece that you had, you know, put together all of the reporterly questions. They were all ready. But you also write that you, and this is how you put it in the piece, I realized I was also here for something else. What was that something else?
This was early on in the pandemic, and it was at a moment when it really did feel like the world was kind of unraveling. We were in the midst of lockdowns. The virus had gotten out of control in parts of the country and in much of the world. And I guess from somewhere deep in my Mormon subconscious, I had that primary song running through my head that we sing in the church as kids. The Follow the Prophet song.
Follow the prophet, follow the prophet, follow the prophet, don't go astray. Follow the prophet, follow the prophet, follow the prophet, he knows the way.
Right, and I guess some part of me was looking for reassurance or guidance or maybe even for the prophet to do or say something dramatic that felt like it was in keeping with this moment of biblical pandemonium. I don't know what he possibly could have done or said to provide that. But to his credit, he was not there for kind of theatrics, right? Instead, he was kind of conversational and friendly and, you know, asked me about my family and my kids and tried, I think, to make me comfortable at the beginning. But then, you know, the notebook opened up and the reporterly job began. And I did not pull any punches. I had a lot of tough questions about the church's stance on LGBT issues, women and the priesthood and women's role in the church and various other tensions within the faith. And I got into all of those. But I mean, I'd be lying if I said that the Mormon part of me was, you know, completely vanished when I was doing that job, right? Mm-hmm. From the very beginning of the process, I kind of knew that I was going to be transparent about who I was. But I also didn't want to feel, and I don't think the church wanted me either, to act like a, you know, a missionary in this situation, right? I wasn't here to write something about the church that would convince people that it was good. I was here to write something honest and true and balanced and nuanced. And that was kind of what I was setting out to do from the beginning. We got to probably a little past the hour mark, and I knew that I was out of time, and so I asked my final questions. And I closed the notebook and thanked him for his time, and he said, "Do you want a picture?" Which I think he's used to any member of the church wanting a picture with him. And I thought, you know, this will be a good artifact for the piece, if nothing else. So we did. We posed together for a picture, and then all of a sudden he was gone. And that was the end of the interview. I had a long walk afterward just to kind of process everything. And as I was thinking about it, I just thought, I guess I took a moment to kind of dwell on the strangeness of the experience and how this was like a very notable personal experience for me, something I'll remember for a long time, but also kind of a really important journalistic experience. And I guess, honestly, if you can probably tell from the way I'm talking about this, I'm still kind of sorting all of that out, trying to process fully the personal and professional experience and how those kind of engage with each other.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today, McKay Coppins is with us to talk about his article in The Atlantic, just published this week. Now, the peg for the piece is the 200th anniversary of the founding of the LDS Church. And in it, Coppins writes about that 200-year Mormon quest for acceptance, something he describes as a centuries-long audition. Mormons have assimilated by now, that's clear, but Coppins says it happened just as the country was on the brink of an identity crisis. And his own faith features prominently in the article. Coppins writes about his own craving for approval growing up Mormon on the East Coast. It makes him invested in this story, and let's be honest, he comes to it with a particular bias. But it's one he cops to, even leans into, he and his editors.
Our editor-in-chief at The Atlantic, Jeffrey Goldberg, has this fascination with Mormonism and has for a long time. And just kind of has always kind of found Mormonism and Mormon people interesting and the Mormon ethos interesting. And so way back when I first joined The Atlantic a number of years ago, he told me that at some point he wanted me to write about Mormonism. And he wasn't sure in what form or how it would work. But the idea was always that I would do something on it. And when it started to get more serious and we started talking about it more, the question did come up. And honestly, I was the one who raised it. I was pretty confident in my ability to write about this faith with the proper, journalistic sensibility. But I also kind of raised the concern, which is, you know, this could be seen as hopelessly conflicted, right? I am a member of the faith. I'm writing about it. And so from the very beginning, his advice was to just lean fully into the personal aspect of it, right? Because it would feel dishonest to try to produce a 9,000 word feature about Mormonism with just a single parenthetical disclosure that I'm a member of the church. And so instead, I tried to kind of be very upfront about my upbringing in the church, the kind of various anxieties I have about my faith, but also, you know, be clear about the fact that I am a practicing member of the faith. And it did, it was, my editors will tell you, they had to push a fair amount, especially early on, to get me to write more in first person, because I'm not, you know, a personal essayist most of the time, right? I tend to write about politics, and I'm usually profiling other people. I'm not writing about myself. And so my editors kind of pressed me to, you know, write about your mission experience, write about your upbringing in the faith, write about growing up Mormon in Massachusetts and what that felt like. And they kind of held my hand and, you know, helped me do that.
So, well, let's talk a little bit more about that. Were you born a Latter-day Saint?
Yeah, I was. I was born into the church. My parents were both basically lifelong members. I think my dad's parents converted when he was very young. But yeah, I was born into the faith and grew up in the church.
So how do you describe your experience as a Mormon who lived, you know, outside of the Intermountain West in what LDS people often describe as the mission field? Pretty typical as for Mormons?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I had an extraordinary experience for Mormons who grew up outside of kind of the Book of Mormon belt, for lack of a better term. I guess, you know, I went to early morning seminary. I was one of only a couple Mormons in my high school. And, you know, I was certainly different. In my high school, we were in a kind of liberal suburb of Boston, and most kids were not religious at all. Those who were mostly Catholic, and so really being religious at all kind of made you different, and then being Mormon made you extremely different. And for the most part, I was fine with that difference. You know, like any teenage boy, had various insecurities and coping mechanisms for those insecurities. And one of them was about, you know, being different because of my religious faith. And I tried to sort of play the part of the cool Mormon or like the likable Mormon, you know. So like I didn't drink, but I was happy to go to parties and be like the designated driver and drive my friends home, you know, and I would never smoke pot, but I would never like narc on you if you smoked pot. Right. I really tried to like cultivate this reputation that where I could be orthodox, but it wasn't the only thing that defined me.
Yeah.
Right. And looking back on it, it's kind of embarrassing. Some of it, because it is kind of undignified, right? All the posturing and the kind of straining to be seen a certain way. But at the time, I actually was really proud of how I could walk this line, because I felt like, you know, look, I'm a Mormon out here where there aren't very many Mormons. And if I can get people to like me and to think that I'm cool, it's actually a win for Mormons everywhere, right?
Yeah.
And I write about this in the piece, how, you know, this is actually like a very common minority religion neurosis, that, you know, you feel like you need to represent your entire global faith tradition in every interaction. You know, at the time, I didn't know that. I didn't know that this was actually a very common thing. And I didn't realize kind of how widespread this sentiment was in Mormonism, this craving for approval, this craving to be seen as mainstream and acceptable, and this, you know, yearning for external validation. I wouldn't really learn about that until much later.
It's interesting you mention how you cultivated a reputation you describe as sanding off the edges of your orthodoxy. So Did you ever struggle, or even now maybe struggle with the, you know, the questions of the more controversial questions of Mormon history, you know, doctrines like banning the priesthood from black members, or, you know, the historical anomalies in the Book of Mormon, questions about the origin of, you know, the church, the character and reputation of Joseph Smith? Did you ever struggle with those kinds of things?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, I actually remember pretty early on, I must have been like 14, finding those, you know, remember those like early AOL message boards or chat rooms or whatever?
Yeah, yeah.
I remember finding one that was for like ex-Mormons or something like that. And that was, I kind of was, you know, accidentally went down this rabbit hole of, you know, all the various controversies, the historical controversies, all the everything about the church that gets brought up in contexts like these. And I remember there, you know, taking some of these to my parents. And again, I must have been 13 or 14. And I don't remember exactly what they said, but I remember that they didn't react with like visceral shock that I was reading this stuff. And they didn't, you know, yell at me or anything. They kind of just calmly engaged with it and encouraged me to continue to, you know, ask questions and be open to things. And I remember that attitude, I think, made it possible for me to explore that stuff while staying devout, right? While staying active in the church. It, none of this stuff felt like deal breakers to me. If that, you know, certainly some of the things, especially the racial issues, and later I would learn more about LGBTQ issues and all of that. But they're definitely not things that I approved of. But I felt like I could stay within the faith and hold on to the things I believed in and the things that mattered to me, while also exploring and kind of grappling with those other problems, and that the two could coexist. And I credit my parents for that.
So, McKay, where did you center your faith, or where do you center your faith? Or as a Latter-day Saint would describe it, your testimony? Like, because it seems to me this is a less of, and you put it this way in the piece, for you it's a less of having this blaze of revelation as much as you say, living the faith day to day. For you it wasn't about, I don't know, it just didn't seem like there was some transcendent moment for you, but you just liked the community part and the fact that there was some sort of discipline required, some sort of action required, and you liked that, it seems.
Especially early on, that was the case. I mean, I did have spiritual experiences and have continued to have spiritual experiences, and so it's not just kind of, you know, a secular appreciation for the community, but it is also that. I think that especially as a teenager, I found that my identity really was wrapped up in my faith, and that the church was where I felt most like myself. You know, I loved the, you know, passing the sacrament as a 12-year-old boy and going to the church dances and all the kind of, you know, cheesy aspects of Mormon youth culture. Even while acknowledging the cheesiness of them, I appreciated them. And I liked the kind of hopeful earnestness of the Mormon ethos and the emphasis on community and service and doing something hard. You know, I definitely from an early age kind of realized that I needed something bigger than myself to believe in to kind of force me to be better than I was, right? The demanding nature of faith to me is really important. I think that a faith that doesn't demand anything of us is sort of pointless. I think if I didn't have this faith and didn't have this church, I don't know how much I would, for example, spend time caring about and getting to know people who are completely outside of my kind of bubble of social interactions, you know, but the Mormon ward forces me to do that. And I appreciate that. And it's something that, that I think is really important and knew was important even when I was a kid.
McKay Coppins, he's a staff writer for The Atlantic magazine. His piece is called The Most American Religion. And you can find a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
all things considered, goes where you are and takes you places you never thought to go.
Right now, the wildfire threat in the Pacific Northwest is extraordinary.
This month marks 10 years since Katrina bore
down. Michael Brown in Ferguson, Eric Garner in New York, Tamir Rice in Cleveland.
In Kentucky today, a county clerk who refused to issue marriage licenses.
There's more to every story. Listen this afternoon.
Today from 4 to 7 on KUER.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're profiling McKay Coppin's new article in The Atlantic about the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints at 200 years. He's asking what a third century will look like for the faith. Coppin's managed to get an interview with Church President Russell M. Nelson, and it features his own perspective as a journalist and as an active Latter-day Saint. So the angle of the piece, I guess the peg for the piece is, of course, it's the bicentennial of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And so what is your – I mean, we'll dig into this as we go, but what is your sort of thumbnail assessment at the bicentennial of this faith? Because you write in the piece that the church has defied expectations. It's become one of the fastest-growing religions in the world. But, of course, then there's that other impression that's come over the last few years because of a series of – self-inflicted wounds, you know, certain controversial policies and inability in some cases to contend with the past and really adapt to the future. It's also hemorrhaging young members. And when you take into account those leaving the church and this internal growth, the number of those actually joining could be receding, or at least it's at a standstill, or at least there's a contention about that. So how are you thinking about the faith in those terms, just your broader assessment of it?
Yeah. So I guess like the, you know, I, as you know, this piece is, it covers a lot of ground. And my big picture assessment is that I think that there is kind of, I don't want to say crisis necessarily in the most urgent sense, but for a lot of members of the church, there's a lack of confidence in where their church is and where it's headed. And that's across the ideological spectrum. You know, whether they're conservative or progressive, whether they're extremely orthodox or less orthodox, I think that there's this sort of anxiety about the status of the church. And when, I interviewed a lot of people over the course of writing this story, and I kept encountering this anxiety, and it was coming from all ends, right? There are people who felt like they were worried that the church was at danger of kind of following the rest of the religious right in America into endless culture war and becoming basically a vehicle for right-wing politics. And then there were others who, if you talk to, you know, more conservative members of the faith, they were worried that the church was going to, you know, be drained of its distinctiveness and vitality and become, you know, become just another mainline Protestant sect, except with the Book of Mormon, you know? And I guess one of the things I wanted to do with this piece was explore what it was that makes Mormonism distinct, you know, and the values that it has, where those values came from. I think they came from a lot, you know, a lot of them came from the native country that, you know, Mormonism has, and a lot of those values are now endangered. But I also think that I also wanted to give, while asking a lot of these difficult questions and exploring these tensions within the faith, also, you know, maybe suggest, and I do this at the end of the piece, that that for Mormonism to offer anything to the country or to the world, it has to come from a place of confidence. It has to come from an embrace of what makes us distinct and different, and not a, you know, not a place of defensiveness or fear. I think so much of American life right now is defined by defensiveness and anxiety and fear, and Mormonism, like every other facet of America, is at risk of falling victim to that. And I don't think that it should. I think that if it wants to be a force for good in the world, it needs to be kind of confident about who it is and confident enough, by the way, to own up to its mistakes and to apologize where necessary and to honestly grapple with its history and its past and make changes where necessary. Because I think that a lot of the hesitation to do that, where there has been hesitation, has also come from a place of fear. And I think that if we were more confident about who we were and more confident about what our faith has to offer and to add, we wouldn't be so afraid of kind of acknowledging the mistakes we've made and rectifying them and repenting for them.
That seems like a key theme in the story of Mormonism, and something you write up about in the piece. This idea that, this is how you put it in the piece. You said Mormons didn't become avatars of a Norman Rockwellian ideal by accident. And people will know what that means. Just the impression of Mormons as really nice, as having fully assimilated. It's almost a caricature. Well, it's not almost a caricature. It is a caricature.
Yeah.
And you describe this process of assimilation as a centuries-long audition for full acceptance into American life. So you've got to be wondering, when are Mormons going to say, all right, we made it. We're here. But you... it seems like you're saying they don't fully understand that yet, or don't fully feel they are accepted. Is that what you're getting at?
They definitely, I think, don't. We don't feel that way. At least a lot of people don't. But I also think that the craving for mainstream approval and acceptance is, you know, while I think it actually has created some positive elements, you know, it has led to a lot of these values I've talked about the emphasis on community, connectedness, care for refugees and immigrants, things like that come out of a desire to be seen as fully American, because that used to be what it meant to be fully American.
Right.
I do think that, you know, I think that that my fellow Mormons and I need to understand that there's no end point to that process, right? There's no like point where we can finally say,
I made it.
We made it. Yeah, yes. We are fully American now. Right. And we got our cards in the mail and everybody likes us and everybody approves of us. And we are seen as model citizens. That's not going to happen. And partly that's not going to happen because the very definition of what it means to be American is in flux, right? So if we're trying to define ourselves by Americanness or mainstream approval, we're going to be constantly chasing this kind of mirage, right? We're never going to get there. And that's why I try to kind of close this piece on a note of, you know, let's just embrace, let's focus on ourselves, right? Let's focus on being better and contributing to the world and not so much on external validation, because that's ultimately kind of a fool's errand.
This is kind of where the story starts to turn in the piece, where you start to talk about the downside of constantly aspiring to this ideal, this American ideal. And you talk about covering the Mitt Romney presidential campaign. Explain what you learned from that experience, because you write about this, where you came to understand that Romney really looked like a relic. And you quote a Mormon scholar, Latter-day Saint scholar and historian, I guess you could describe him that way, Terrell Givens, as saying this. I want to read this quote. It is now because Mormons occupy what used to be the center that they fall into contempt. Explain what Givens is getting at there, that Mormons in the center have fallen into contempt, and how you came to see Romney, or at least the impression of others came to see Mitt Romney as a kind of relic. What are you getting at there?
Yeah, well, Mitt Romney was the perfect illustration of this, right?
Yeah,
he was
yeah.
such a clear product of Mormonism.
Right. Like,
he was born into the faith, served a mission, went to BYU, you know, married his high school sweetheart, raised five strapping sons. Mm. He's like the Christmas card, you know, ideal of a Mormon family, right? And And everything about him, the professional success, the good manners, the cheerfulness, the kind of wholesome, Mormon dad diction, all of it was so thoroughly Mormon, and all of it had been kind of cultivated by generations of Mormon assimilators, where all of his ancestors were trying to become more and more American. And what he found and what Mormons found was that in 2012, when you put that on the national stage and presented it to the country for kind of ratification, it turns out that a lot of Americans didn't see that as fully mainstream. In fact, a lot of people were kind of creeped out by it, right? Mm-hmm. He was seen as sort of preening or phony or artificial, and out of step with where contemporary American life was. And then at the same time, he was contending with a lot of the kind of old bigotries toward Mormonism, where you had people like Jacob Weisberg at Slate writing a piece arguing that nobody who believed in such a transparent and recent fraud as Mormonism could be trusted with the presidency. And I think for a lot of Mormons, it was sort of a clarifying experience. And certainly for me, it was as a reporter covering the Mitt Romney campaign, that this kind of ideal of Mormon men, right? This guy who embodied all of those assimilative efforts within Mormonism could be rejected by most of the country. I think it sort of illustrated the degree to which the Mormon assimilation project was had gone awry. Something was amiss in that project.
Well, you come to this realization that, as a theater critic told you, Mormonism has no cultural cachet. Explain what got you to that point, because it has to do with the Broadway show, the Book of Mormon.
Yeah, well, so people will remember that during the 2012 election, you had the Book of Mormon musical, which was blowing up on Broadway, right? And I think it got a lot of oxygen from the fact that the Republican presidential nominee was a Mormon, but it was winning Tonys and selling out every night. And it was this huge phenomenon. It was, Hamilton before it was Hamilton. And I remember listening to the soundtrack. I could never get tickets to it, but I remember listening to the soundtrack and sort of feeling exasperated that, this was the most popular depiction of my faith in pop culture, that this was how all these people who were going to see the musical were going to be introduced to my faith. But I also felt like I had to be a good sport about it. And I feel like that was kind of the Mormon response to the Book of Mormon musical, right? The church took out ads in the playbill saying, "You've read the play, now read the book." And so we all kind of did our nice Mormon thing where we just kind of shrugged at it and played along and hoped that everybody would think that we could take a joke and, we're so good natured. But then I remember one night in New York, I met a theater critic who had recently seen the Book of Mormon musical, and he was marveling at how the show had somehow gotten away with being so kind of sneering and ruthless toward a minority religion without any blowback or any meaningful backlash at all. And I kind of stepped in and tried to cast this as a testament to, the good-natured Mormon niceness, right? And this critic was sort of, really blunt with me. And he said, "No, it's because your people have absolutely no cultural cachet." And it wasn't really until that kind of conversation that I suddenly kind of understood that the Mormon niceness that we were exhibiting toward this musical and towards so many other things, and that I had exhibited towards so many kind of jokes about polygamy and about Mormon underwear and whatever else, was actually a coping mechanism. And it came from this sort of sweaty, pathetic, desperation to be liked. And I think that was actually a turning point for me, because I found that sort of humiliating when I kind of realized it. And it kind of occurred to me that this endless quest for external validation is never going to end well, right? It's never going to lead any place good. It's just going to lead to more kind of disappointment and humiliation, because as we teach all of our, you know, kids in, who go to school, when you define yourself by how other people see you, you're never going to really be happy. And I think that that was kind of where I ended up after the 2012 election, when in terms of how I thought about all this.
What it comes down to, it seems like in the piece for you, is sort of this question that you ask. What happens when a religious group discovers that it's spent 200 years assimilating to an America that no longer exists? Break that down for me. What you're saying is there's a lack of what, reformation within the church, or adaptation, a lack of seeing what's changing within what we refer to as the American identity. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what time period you would place it in, but I guess I feel like American Mormonism, at least, has sort of shaped its ethos around a 1950s America, or maybe you could say a 1980s America, somewhere like that. That was
Reagan,
you know,
Reagan or Eisenhower, maybe.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
like you know, fiercely patriotic, all about family, all about kind of civic, you know, community service, and it wasn't. It's not just the ideals, but also the aesthetic, right? Like, you know, you walk into a typical Mormon chapel in a lot of America, and you see kind of literally a Norman Rockwell painting kind of played out in real life in front of you.
Right.
The you know, the nuclear families and their well-dressed, you know, well-behaved young children, and they're sitting in the pews. And you know, there's nothing wrong with any of that. But again, when your whole goal is acceptance or approval, it becomes a problem when the entire kind of ethos is formed around an ideal that kind of went out of style with Eisenhower or maybe Reagan, right? And so I think that we are in a period now in the church where, especially as America sort of fractures and turns on itself, and we're seeing all these very dramatic divisions unfold before us, we're being forced to grapple with kind of what we want to stand for, what we want to be, what we believe. And this is why, part of why I think that you see this loose coalition of liberal reformers sort of gaining ground within the faith, as they're kind of pushing the church to reconsider where it stands on various questions, and how much of this is actually doctrinal and how much of it is rooted in that 1950s American aesthetic that may or may not actually need to be part of the faith as we head into the third century.
You write this kind of jarring intro into a paragraph in the piece. Let me read it. On a nightstand next to his bed, Russell M. Nelson keeps a notebook where he records his revelations. Now, for Latter-day Saints, that makes sense. but explain for those who don't understand the way you know Mormons are thinking about this, because you call revelation the most practical of Mormon doctrine. And you describe it as a survival mechanism. Talk a little bit about this part.
The common Mormon understanding of revelation in our day-to-day lives is it's not necessarily angels appearing to us or God opening up the heavens. It's, you know, impressions that we get after praying or, you know, considering a question. So he keeps this notebook to write down the impressions he gets throughout the night about, you know, any number of questions related to running the church. But the broader kind of Mormon claim to prophetic revelation, I think, is it seems audacious or very kind of dramatic to outsiders, but I think when you look at the church's history, it also has played an important role in terms of allowing the church to adapt and reform as necessary throughout its history, right? Rather than kind of changing things in an ad hoc way, based on pressure kind of coming from various quarters. You can instead put the question to the prophet or to, you know, the church leaders and allow them to pray about it and consider it, and then say that they've been prompted to do something by God. It you know, from an objective standpoint, it allows the church to kind of hold its orthodoxy, its doctrine together while continuing to evolve.
But it seems like skeptics could say that it's just an easy way out of taking responsibility. I mean, when you ascribe anything you do to God, like Russell Nelson did when he called the policy depriving, you know, the children of same-sex couples membership in the church, he called that a revelation from God. Or when leaders say they don't understand why God would ban black people from the priesthood as long as he did, you know, they're blaming God. I mean, that seems like that's the counter side to revelation. It's a constant way out. You never have to take responsibility if it's always God's fault.
Mm. And I think this is one of the most fascinating tensions that we see the church grappling with in real time right now, right? I think race is probably the best illustration of this.
Yeah. So, which you write about in the piece, we should say, yes.
Yeah. So the priesthood ban for black men and the banning of black families from participating in important temple ordinances, you know, was lifted in 1978. And since then, the church has kind of made fitful efforts to reckon with that history. But I don't think anyone is, you know, certainly a lot of black members don't feel like the church has fully reckoned with it. But it's a good example of what you're talking about. That tension has made it harder for church leaders to simply come out and say, you know, we were wrong. We apologize. Please forgive us. And we're going to move forward together and rectify this.
So, as you reflect on your hour-long conversation with Russell M. Nelson, did he give you much?
Yeah. No, I mean, he did. He answered my questions. He was actually, I mean, look, I interview, you know, senators and presidential candidates for a living. I would say he was much less evasive than the average presidential candidate, which is maybe a low bar, but he did clear that. But, you know, a lot of the answers that he gave were ones that I think I would have expected. And he, for the most part, hewed pretty closely to mainstream church doctrines and teachings. And though I think there was a moment toward the end of the interview where he actually closed the notebook in front of him and sort of became quiet for a second and then gave me a really thoughtful and I thought pretty candid assessment of how he thought he would be judged after he died. Then sort of talked about how he was going to have his interview with God. And he said, I doubt if I'll be judged by the growth of the church during my presidency. I don't think it'll be a quantitative experience. And then he went on to list the questions he thinks he will face, which are, what about your faith? What about virtue? What about your knowledge? Were you temperate? Were you kind to people? Did you have charity, humility? It was clear that he kind of felt the clock ticking, right? Mm-hmm. He knows that he's near the end of his life. He knows he has a limited amount of time and he's trying to make the most of it. And I thought that was kind of interesting to see him kind of think through that in front of me, given all these other things we've talked about and what's going on in the world and what's going on in the church.
It does make me wonder, because you mentioned, you know, you talk about this growing liberal coalition inside the church that's pushing for reform. But if Russell M. Nelson is, as you say, hewing close to mainstream doctrines, because you talked to him, for example, about the church's stand on LGBTQ issues, and he didn't seem to offer much in the way of hope that the church would ever, for example, accept gay people who choose to be intimate with their partners, you know, as fully realized members of the faith. So is Russell M. Nelson the leader to take Mormonism into this moment of reformation?
I think that President Nelson has made a number of changes that don't seem dramatic to people outside the faith, but that at least incrementally are moving it in a more progressive direction, right? So one of the most notable things I think he's done, or I guess set of things he's done, are related to women in the church. So he obviously hasn't extended the priesthood to women. but he has changed temple ordinances and the kind of tweaked the organizational structure of local wards to emphasize authority for women in the church. And those things don't, they don't lend themselves well to headlines or slogans, but they do matter to a lot of women in the faith, right? I talked to one person who called Russell M. Nelson an incrementalist. And I think you could say that he has certainly addressed some of the issues, but has done so in a kind of slow and gradual way, as opposed to kind of a dramatic way. And my guess is, knowing this institution and now having spent a good amount of time reporting on it, that's just how change happens in this church. I don't see, maybe I'm wrong, and I you know, I'd be happy to be proven wrong at any time, but I don't see the church making kind of huge dramatic gestures very often on any of these tensions. I think instead they're constantly thinking through them, tinkering with things, tweaking them, you know, trying to talk to various stakeholders and slowly and gradually addressing the issues, rather than kind of making bold reforms all at once.
What's the core of Mormonism? You say it's this surprised me. You said it's kind of hard to identify. So it's hard to know what to jettison and what to keep. I loved how you interviewed Kathleen Flake, and what she said is, this is like strip poker. The question is just, how far will you go? How far will they go? Because you also mentioned, you know, you have these conversations with fellow Mormons, and the question is, you know, in the not so distant future, will Mormonism have something approaching the priesthood for women? Will leaders officially apologize for, you know, the racist past of former leaders? LGBTQ people, will they be allowed full fellowship and even be married in LDS temples? I mean, how are you thinking about all of that?
I mean, I obviously have my own opinions about what should happen with all of those issues. You know, aside from that, to me, the question is the template that the church is using and Mormons are using to answer these questions. Because whatever the core of Mormonism is, I just think it's important that it retains the hard parts, right?
You don't want a fully diluted Mormonism is what you say. You want it to be confident in what it is.
Yeah, you know, I talked to Mitt Romney for this piece, and I've interviewed him a number of times over the past year about his the kind of lonely political moment he finds himself in. And he told me that his upbringing in the church had sort of steeled him for this moment. And he told me one of the advantages of growing up in the church outside of Utah is that, and this is his quote, "You are different in ways that are important to you." And, you know, all these small moments throughout a Mormon life where you decide not to drink while your friends are drinking, or you, you know, press pause on your college education to go serve a mission or whatever else, they kind of pile up over a lifetime. And they make it so that when a true test of conscience arrives, you're not in a position, this is what Romney says, where you don't know how to stand for something that's hard. And that's not unique necessarily to Mormonism, but I do think any kind of Orthodox faith that demands that you be different in small ways can help you to be different in important ways later in life. However we as a people, as a church, decide to define the core of Mormonism, I hope that it's demanding. I hope that it still demands something of us. Because at least for me, that's what that's where the value comes. That's what makes it worthwhile. And as I raise my own kids in the church now, I want them to have those experiences because it builds character. It makes you hopefully a better person. Now, I don't think any of those questions about LGBT issues or race or gender need to be resolved in a conservative way to retain the hard parts of Mormonism. But I do think that we are at a risk of diluting the faith so fully in our kind of ongoing constant quest for outside approval, that we end up in a place where the faith doesn't demand that much. And I think that would be a tragedy. That would be a shame.
McKay Coppins, thanks very much.
Thank you.
McKay Coppins. He's a staff writer for The Atlantic magazine. His article about the LDS Church is called The Most American Religion. There's a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter, at Radio West. Our intern is Ivana Martinez. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.